This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
The users of naval guns, millions of tons of bombs, and revolting napalm cannot speak to Negroes about violence. Only those who are fighting for peace have the moral authority to lecture on nonviolence. Now, of course, there are some who say that we can fight both wars and have at the same time a war in Vietnam and a war against poverty here at home. Theoretically, the United States has resources for both, but an iron logic dictates that we shall never voluntarily do both for two reasons. First, the majority of the present Congress and the administration, as distinguished from the majority of the people, is single-mindedly devoted to the pursuit of the war. It has been estimated that we spend about $500,000 to kill a single Viet Cong soldier, and yet we spend about $53 for each impoverished American in anti-poverty programs. Congress appropriates military funds with alacrity and generosity. It appropriates poverty funds with miserliness and grudging reluctance. The government is emotionally committed to the war. It is emotionally hostile to the needs of the poor. For this reason, I do not see the possibility of fighting both of these wars. The time has come for all people of goodwill and all people committed to peace to take a stand and make it clear that when a nation becomes obsessed with the guns of war, social programs inevitably suffer. And we can talk about guns and butter all we want to, but when the guns are there with all of this emphasis, you don't even get good oleo. These are the facts of life. Beyond the tragedy at the front, at home, the young people are torn with confusion, which tend to explain most of the extremes of some conduct. This generation has never known a severe economic crisis, but it has known something far worse. It is the first generation in American history to experience four wars in 25 years. World War II, the Cold War, the Korean War, and the war in Vietnam. It is the generation of wars, and it shows the scars in widespread drug consumption, alienation, and feverish pursuit of sensual pleasures. Yet we cannot call this generation of the young the lost generation. We are the lost generation because it is we who failed to give them the peaceful society they were promised in American history. As I talk about the war, let me also say that our whole nation is living in a terrible, isolated, and alienated atmosphere. The government is isolated from the majority of the people who want either withdrawal, de-escalation, or honest negotiations, not what they are now given. In addition to the isolation of the government from its people, that is our national isolation in the world, we are without a single significant international ally. Every major nation has avoided active involvement on our side. We are more alone than we have been since the founding of the Republic. And lastly, and more ironically, we are isolated from the very people whom we profess to support, the South Vietnamese. In their elections, the pro-war forces received less than one-third of the vote. In the countryside, most of the area of South Vietnam is in the hands of the Viet Cong, and the Army of South Vietnam has so reduced its role in the fighting, it may shortly become the first pacifist army in the history of the world. And so we have a responsibility to continue to take a stand against this unjust war. And I want to commend you for the stand that you've already taken. I remember when I first took a stand against the war in Vietnam. I'd been against it, but I hadn't come out too vigorously against it, and I decided that I had to do it on the basis of conscience. And I started getting all of the newspaper editorials. They were writing some very terrible editorials about me. And they told me to stick to civil rights. And these were not, this wasn't only the so-called white press. Some Negro leaders told me that too. Heard in the civil rights movement, you got to stick to civil rights. And finally I had to answer that, and the only way I could answer it was by saying that for about 12 years now, ever since the Montgomery bus boycott, I have been struggling and fighting against segregation. And I have been working too long and too hard now against segregated public accommodations to end up segregating my moral concerns. In a real sense, justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Well, the other criticism came, which said in substance, I remember when someone first placed this question to me, said, Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy since you've taken your stand against the war? You've been severely criticized, and many people who once respected you will not respect you now. And I understand that the budget of your organization has been hurt as a result of your stand. And don't you think for all of these reasons that you will have to reverse your position and agree more with administration's policy? And I had to look at the gentleman and say, I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. Now, I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a molder of consensus.
Make me fully whole. know. Speak, Lord Jesus. Please speak to my soul. Speak, Lord Jesus, and make me fully whole. Speak, Lord Jesus, till all doubts unfold. In sickness or sorrow, oh Lord, your joy will be known. Been heavy laden, and my heart been sad. I couldn't find, Lord, comfort. Speak, Lord Jesus, make me fully whole. Speak, Lord Jesus, tell all doubts be not full. In sickness or in sorrow,
it's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Yeah, real quick, good morning, and I'd like to share with you some Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches in the next hour. And few good gospel songs from way back. So that was Mahalia Jackson, and sit back, relax, and let's, everyone like to quote him, but how often do we sit to listen? So we'll seize this opportunity, and in the next hour we'll do some chatting and hold your phone calls, and we'll accommodate you. So thanks for listening.
We read about it in the Beauties of Literature. In a sense, Edgar Allan Poe was talking about Eros when he talked about his beautiful Annabel Lee with a love surrounded by the halo of eternity. In a sense, Shakespeare was talking about Eros when he said, love is not love, which alters whence alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempest and is never shaken. It is a star to every wandering bark. You know, I can remember that because I used to quote it to my wife when we were courting. That's Eros. That's Eros. Then the Greek language talks about phileo, which is another level of love. It is an intimate affection between personal friends. On this level, we love because we are love. We love people that we like. This is friendship. Then the Greek language has another word called agape. Agape is more than romantic love. Agape is more than friendship. Agape is not something affectionate. Agape is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. It is an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. Theologians would say that it is the love of God operating in the human heart. And when one rises to love on this level, he loves men not because he likes them, but he loves every man because God loves him.
Yeah.
He goes on with that. And so he rises to the level of hating the system rather than the individual who is caught up in that system. He loves the person and hates the evil deed. And I think this is what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. And I'm happy that he didn't say, like your enemies, because it's pretty difficult to like some people. It's difficult to like people bombing your home and threatening your children and kicking you about. But Jesus says, love them, and love is greater than like. Love is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. And somehow, more and more, I've come to believe this. This is the way that we will get out of this dark night of oppression and make of this nation a better nation. It means that we can stand up and allow the opposition to know that we will not accept injustice. We will stand up against it with our lives, but we will never stoop down to the level of violence and hatred. And we will come to that point when we will be able to convince him that a new world is emerging. And I tell you this evening that it will give us the right attitude. I know sometimes how discontent we get, and we have a right to get discontent, and how frustrated we get in the process sometimes. But I submit to you this evening that this way of nonviolence will help us not to seek to rise from a position of disadvantage to one of advantage, thus subverting justice. We will not substitute one tyranny for another. For black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy. I am convinced this afternoon that God is not interested merely in the freedom of black men and brown men and yellow men. God is interested in the freedom of the whole human race and the creation of a society. I believe with this method and this approach, we will be able to win. And finally, as we struggle, we do not struggle alone. It's dark sometimes. It's difficult. And particularly for those who are struggling in the Deep South, facing all of the violence and all of the suffering. But that is something that consoles us along the way. We are convinced that our cause is right. I return to Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, not in despair, not in bitterness. I return knowing that we are moving into a bright day of freedom.
Yes.
We, through our struggles, through our suffering, through our sacrifice, will be able to achieve the American dream. And this will be the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
I come this morning to try to preach. And I would like for all of us, men and women alike, to think with me from the subject, A Knock at Midnight.
Amen.
Our text this morning is taken from one of the familiar parables of our Lord and Master found in the 11th chapter of the Gospel as recorded by St. Luke. It begins at the 5th verse. And he said unto them, which of you shall have a friend, and shall go unto him at midnight and say unto him, friend, lend me 3 loaves. For a friend of mine in his journey is come to me, and I have nothing to set before him. And he
from within shall answer and say, trouble me not. The door is now shut and my children are with me in bed.
Yes.
I cannot rise and give thee. But I say unto you, though he will not rise and give him, because he is his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him as many as he needeth. Now this is a parable dealing with the power of persistent prayer. But one of the things we always notice about the parables of Jesus is that although they were always told to get over one basic thought, you can usually find in every parable of Jesus great facets of thought not intended as a main point. And if I look at this parable, I see within it a basic outline and a basic guide in dealing with many of the problems that we confront in our nation and in the world today, and the role of the church. Now, the first thing that we notice in this parable is that it is midnight. It is also midnight in our world today. We are experiencing a darkness so deep that we can hardly see which way to turn. It's midnight.
Well, I
It's midnight in the social order. Now, the Middle East has had the headlines over the last few days, but it should not all cause us to forget that there is another war. It's a futile, bloody, costly war taking place on Asian soil. We look over to Vietnam, and what do we see? We see the rice fields of a little Asian country being burned at will and trampled at whim. We see innocent peasants and little children being burned with napalm. Then we see the fine young men of our country dying in mounting numbers. All of this is indicative of the fact that it's midnight. The nations of the world are engaged in a bitter and tragic contest for supremacy. And you see, the real danger is that if we don't change our course in this world, all of the modern weapons of warfare will soon conspire to bring an untimely death to the human family on this globe. The late President Kennedy was right. Mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. Not only is it midnight in man's collective life, but it's midnight in his individual life. It's midnight in the psychological order. People are more worried, more frustrated, more bewildered today than at any period of human history. So many of us find that clouds of anxiety are floating in our mental skies. The psychopathic wards of our hospitals are full today. Who are the popular psychologists today? They are the psychoanalysts who delve into the inner chambers of the subconscious. What are the popular books in psychology? They are books entitled Man Against Himself, Modern Man in Search of a Soul, The Neurotic Personality of Our Times. What are the popular books, the bestsellers in religion today? They are books entitled Peace of Mind, Peace of Soul. And who are the popular preachers? They are so often preachers who would preach nice little soothing sermons on how to be happy, how to relax, how to keep your blood pressure down. And so we have retranslated the gospel to read, go ye into all the world and keep your blood pressure down, and lo, I will make you a well-adjusted personality. All of this is indicative of the fact that it is midnight in the psychological order. Not only that, it's midnight in the moral order. Midnight is a time when all colors lose their distinctiveness, and everything becomes merely a dirty shade of gray. In the sense of the moral order, midnight is a time when all moral values lose their distinctiveness. And so in our world today, for so many people, there's nothing absolutely right, nothing absolutely wrong. Just a matter of what the majority of people are doing. Over and over again, we see this. Most people live by the philosophy, everybody is doing it, so it must be all right. It's midnight in the moral order. And you know, midnight is a time when everybody's trying to get by. And this is exactly what we have done so often. We have ended up with our ethical relativism, feeling that the only thing right is to get by. And the only thing wrong is to get caught. And so today we don't talk about the Darwinian survival of the fittest. That was a theory that came along, but for us it's a philosophy of the survival of the slickest. Nobody is concerned about obeying the Ten Commandments in so many instances. They are not important. Everybody is busy trying to obey the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. According to this tragic philosophy, it's all right to lie, but just lie with a bit of finesse. It's all right to exploit and rob, but be a dignified exploiter so that when you do it, it becomes embezzlement rather than just stealing. It's all right even to hate, but dress your hate in the garments of love and make it appear that you are loving when you are actually hating. Just get by. This tragic moral laxity, this tendency to be caught up in the chains of conformity, is destroying the soul of our nation, the soul of the world, and so many individuals. We find ourselves today standing in the midst of a threefold midnight. It's midnight in the social order. It's midnight in the psychological order. It's midnight in the moral order. But as in the parable, so in our world today, the deep darkness of the midnight is interrupted by a knock. The parable talked about this man seeking three loaves of bread, physical bread. In our world today, men and women are in search for three loaves of spiritual bread. They want the bread of faith. So many people have lost faith in themselves. They've lost faith in their neighbors. They've lost faith in God.
Millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But that is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this other America, millions of people find themselves walking the streets in search for jobs that do not exist. In this other America, millions of people are forced to live in dilapidated, substandard housing conditions where they do not have wall-to-wall carpet, but where they all too often have wall-to-wall rats and roaches. In this other America, thousands of young people finish college or high school rather every year, reading at an eighth grade or ninth grade level, not because they are dumb, not because they don't have native intelligence, but because the schools are so inadequate, so overcrowded, so devoid of quality, so segregated, if you will, that the best in these minds can never come out. And I guess the most critical problem in the other America is the economic problem. For in this other America, we find some 40 million of our brothers and sisters perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Unemployment is still wide in the black community. The Negro finds himself in the midst of a major depression every day. Now, the problem is that when that is mass unemployment in the black community and other minority communities, we call it a social problem. When there's mass unemployment in the white community, we call it a depression. But it is a depression just the same in the black community and in the poor community generally. And I need not pause to give the figures. They are before us every day. Now, unemployment is not the only problem. Underemployment is just as great or even greater. For most of the poverty-stricken people in our country are working every day. But they are making wages so inadequate that they cannot begin to function in the mainstream of economic life of the nation. They are working, in many instances, full-time jobs for part-time income. Now, because of this economic deprivation, that is a great deal of bitterness, a great deal of despair, a great deal of anger on the part of millions of people in the other America. And we've seen this anger, this despair express itself in the violent explosions that have taken place over the last few summers. We have seen our cities burning. We have seen all of the agony and all of the tension as a result of all of this. But what we must also say as we look at this, that somehow we must find the causal basis. Everybody knows that, or who knows me, knows that I'm committed to nonviolence, and I still believe that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom and justice. But it is not enough for me to say that. It is not enough for one to stand up and condemn a riot. It is just as necessary for people of goodwill and concern to vigorously condemn the intolerable conditions that continue to exist in our society. Somewhere we must come to see that a riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and democracy have not been met. It has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice and humanity. Now, every year at about this time, our newspapers and our televisions and people in general start talking about the long, hot summer ahead. And what always bothers me is the fact that the long, hot summer has always been preceded by long, cold weather. And the problem is the nation hadn't done enough with its winters. It has not used its winters creatively enough to develop the programs and the massive concern that will solve the great problems that we face. And so it is necessary to say that our nation's summers of riots are still caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as justice is postponed, we will always have the possibility of these dark days of social disruption. And so something must be done to solve these great problems. And I'd like to take a minute just to mention some of the plans we have in mind, and unfortunately I will not have too long to go into it. But as you know, direct action was a powerful weapon that we used all across the South to deal with many of the evils that engulfed that area of the country. We had movement after movement, and assault after assault. We finally brought an end to the system of legal segregation through powerful nonviolent direct action. And then we used this method also in Selma, Alabama, to finally grapple with the whole political issue of the denial of the right to vote. We were finally able to get a voting rights bill. So there were some legislative victories as a result of those direct action movements. But we must understand what these movements did not do. Number one, they did not rid our nation of racism. Number two, while they did a great deal to rectify long-standing evils in the North, they did very little to penetrate.
Concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
every man, he loves a song. That's what my God tells me. And I say it's taken him so long, 'cause we've got so far to run. But in my heart I can feel it.
It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now here's Carol.
Hey, thank you for joining in and listening to the Carol Cox Show. I thought I'd share that to remember tomorrow's birthday parade for Dr. Martin Luther King. It starts at 9 o'clock. And you can join them and assemble there at the Magic Island, as usual. And hopefully that you'll be inspired to go for, if nothing else, just to show that you care and we care. So I got a few calls here, and we'll come back in the next hour. Caller, good morning. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
First of all, sorry that Byron can't be here, but his brother is, and if you want to talk to him, Dr. Larry Rush, in the next hour, I'll be sure to have him call in.
I thought he wasn't going to be in the till 3.
Larry is here. Byron is not.
Okay. I have a couple other things that I have, but anyway, yeah, I would try and call, but... we'll see. I didn't get any. I got your message late this morning. By then, I had, as you can see, I had put something together there. So, but anyway, the parade real quickly because we got I got two other calls. The parade starts at 9, and assembles at Magic Island. And can people still sign up to be party to it?
Oh yeah, they always do.
Okay, so they can. They'll have sign up booths there. Fees. Let me get these other calls right quick.
The Unity Rally at Kapi'olani Park all afternoon.
Okay, but we'll have time in the next hour. Let me just try to catch it. Thank you. Caller, go ahead. Good morning. What's your comment or question?
Hi, Carol. Real quick. I'll call back in the next hour. But, you know, did you see the movie Selma?
No, I didn't.
You'll have to. I was in tears that whole movie. And it gave me a sense of inspiration of, you know, the Selma March and all that, and how the difficulties, but how finally, you know, they got the political, President Johnson did.
Okay, let's take that up in the next hour. Let me just try to get that one.
So I'll call back.
Go ahead, caller, with your comment or question. Hello. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Come on.
Okay, well, we'll see you in the next hour. And I apologize for the hoarseness here, but we'll be back shortly.
Stay tuned for the second half of the Carol Cox Show right after the news on KWAI Honolulu, K101.
This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial. This is KWAI Honolulu 1080 on the AM dial.
It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now here's Carol.
Okay, welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. We had a little bit of a problem there, but it's not a problem when you got a technician like Francis behind you. He got your back, so nothing like good support. You can tell right off the bat he's not a state worker. He sits around, works, and when it breaks, he fixes. Right there, like that. You know, definitely not a government worker, I can tell you that much. Got to take pride in his work and always on the button, on the dial. So anyway, I hope that you enjoyed or appreciate some of the Dr. Martin Luther King speeches or portions of them. And for me, you know, the holiday of all things when I was young, and I've often wondered, when would we and why were we always celebrating holidays, days that really meant little or nothing, or if at most were insulting, you know, the Columbus Day or Discovery Day or whatever you want to call it. It was as though we're celebrating someone for discovering someone that's already in place and existing and having a culture. And I just think the insult, but as a child growing up, just to let you know that a great many of these things, they play hard and heavy and weigh hard and heavy on the hearts of young people, that you may not know this, but we are observant, and it translates into pain. So when Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday and the holiday was granted, passed, that was something that I believe that we celebrate every day, because it was a grand lifting. And for some of you that think Obama is a Muslim, a trash man, or whatever you want to lay on him, this is making America whole again when we see these images of a African American, a black man, in the White House. That, you may not value that, but stand aside and just allow some of us to appreciate that, because you haven't walked in our moccasins. And not speaking to the politics, and if you are out there and you want to jam on Obama, then I would simply say what you should do is be equally concerned that we would even have slavery, we would even continue on this path that we are without considering all people. Caller, good morning. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Hi, Carol, again. That movie, Selma, it brought back so much memories and actually pain, too. I just mentioned virtual tears out of the movie. But when it came out, it was very inspiring, too, because it brought back what happened. Martin Luther King was a brilliant strategist, too, in order to organize all these diverse people. I mean, the black folks, too, were very, there was not ex folks, and there was a Black Panther folks, and there was that were more on the violent tendency, and then there was a violent coordinating committee, SNCC, and this movie really depicted how they had to kind of come to a middle ground. Really, Martin Luther King had to tell them it's so important to stick to nonviolence. And of course, you remember this all could have not happened at an earlier history either, because of a TV set. We finally could see people getting beaten to the ground by white cops with billy clubs, it was on national TV.
Right.
And then it really woke up the conscience of America, especially up north and white folks. And it also awakened another brilliant strategy he has to get the clergy on his side. I mean, Jews and Gentiles and Catholics and Protestants and the whole works.
Well,
part of the movement, the Selma March,
Right. I often hear people talk about Dr. King and his accomplishments and the great, wonderful things that I appreciate him doing, but we must not forget when the abolitionists, there were not all people on this planet wanting to have, in America, have slaves, and they were of many colors, white and everything.
Oh, yeah.
So we have to be careful. I suggest that while we enamor, or I won't use the term glorify, I don't want to overstress Dr. Martin Luther King's accomplishments while putting the abolitionists and the civil rights movement, the freedom riders, the northern people, the southern people. They're not all southerners were racist.
Oh, no.
And so we must remember that, because if we do that, then what we're saying to today's generation is that only you of your own ilk can fight for yourself.
Right.
And we don't want to give that message. And we saw that in the same-sex debate, and see it now, where many African-Americans say the same-sex issue is really not civil rights. And that's the wonderful thing that Dr. King did. He did not single out and speak for just one people or one type.
Yeah.
So that would be my admonishment to any listener out there, is to say, let's not, while we know the accomplishments, but we must not forget the Underground Railroad through Ohio and down into the South. Who were those people to hide blacks? They weren't blacks, many of them.
Oh, yeah.
And who were those abolitionists that stood up so many things, and I think that's the danger. And why we see this fragmentation, because a lot of people think that Dr. Martin Luther King is just for black people. And what it was is a nation healing itself.
Oh, no, he was for the principles that we supposedly stick for,
Right, but I mean, it was a nation that was, the nation was actively involved fighting against this. and Republicans and Democrats and other parties, even to the Lincoln parties, and you understand.
Oh yeah. Well, you know what it was too. It really took grassroots movement, and then we had President Johnson in the White House, and he was very resistant. This movie brought out that really good too. That how President Johnson, we're working on war and poverty, but we can't be bothered with this voting rights thing right now.
Right.
Within 6 months. That was changed around. Martin Luther King got to talk with him, President Johnson, a number of times, and I think the biggest pressure on President Johnson was the media at the time.
Yeah.
The TV networks and even the liberal newspapers we actually had back in those days, and it really got people to say, hey, no, that's not fair. Right. Everybody has the right to vote, wherever they are.
Well, you take, for example, the giving credit where credit is due, if necessary, but I don't think in this instance. But there were a lot of Jewish people, of the Jewish faith, I should say, that were aggressively involved in fighting for civil rights, too. And we, today, for some reason, we tend to want to put that aside, throw it aside.
Oh, yeah.
You understand? And that is something. I play Dr. King because those particular speeches, because he speak to some of that.
Well, the Catholics, a lot of Catholics. There was a lot of nuns and priests involved in that march. The neat thing about this movie and Selma, they showed some of the actual tapes back, black and white tapes of the. Then they flashed to the play acting of the march from Selma to Montgomery. He really brought back memories of George Wallace. You know, the segregation now, segregation forever. It was so interesting how he kind of transformed his beliefs too. As he got older, and he figured, you know what, those black folks down south. I mean. Down in my state, they were good people, in the beginning. But he was under all kinds of forces back in his time, and the white racism that was back then, and the brutal sheriffs and cops.
Let me get the other caller here.
Sure.
Right, thank you.
Thank you for playing those speeches too. It really brought back memories.
Okay, Dave. All right. Thanks.
Good
morning, Carlo. Go ahead with your comments or questions. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi. This is Larry Rushing.
Oh, hi, Larry. How are you?
I'm fine. Doing well. And you?
I'm fine. I'm sorry to hear about your brother. And you were here for the services, are you?
That's right, and I'm also here for the Martin Luther King Parade.
Okay.
Tomorrow. And I'm going to be the Grand Marshal. So in a sense, my brother was the Grand Marshal last year.
Okay.
That was Byron.
Right.
And so it's a pleasure to be able to participate in this march because Billy Rushing, who's now deceased, as you mentioned, he had a great deal to do, as you know, with organizing the parade. So I'm, in a sense, representing him, too.
And where do you do, what do you do, and where you hail from?
I am an emeritus professor of psychology and black studies from a college in City University of New York.
Okay. And are you actively involved in the efforts back there on civil rights or any activities?
Yes, I am. I always have been. I have been participating most recently in the protests against police brutality in New York City, and specifically in Brooklyn, New York, where I live.
Uh-huh.
So far, I participated in three demonstrations and die-ins in Brooklyn in which people close off major avenues in Brooklyn in order to conduct their protests. Mm-hmm.
And what is the efforts to address the black-on-black crime? Is there any organizations are speaking to that? Because I know the police are shooting people and treating people unjustly. But are we going to address the black-on-black, the quote, black-on-black crime?
Well, I think all black people, I think, are concerned with black-on-black crime. But we're also concerned with the crime against innocent black people by the people who are paid to protect black people. You know, these are two important things, but they are separate. Black-on-black crime is criminals attacking and brutalizing black people. But in the case of the police, you have people who are paid to protect people and who are not protecting people and who are doing the opposite. And they are acting like criminals, but they're being paid in order to do something which they're not doing.
But
both important. And right now, I think where the movement is to stop the violence and the illegal activities on the part of the police.
I'm with you 100%. But I do believe, in my opinion, that black on black crime simply is an invitation to the rogue cop. And if we continue to behave like baboons in a murder and killing one another, then what message does that send? No one cares. So if we address that, and we have to show the responsibility, I believe, and that sends a message that the community is not fragmented, starting first, then you have a greater argument. I mean, it's wrong to kill someone over a cigarette or choke them to death. That's because of their race.
That's absolutely correct. But the problem in American society is a problem of crime. Period. Whether it be black on black or white on white. I mean, most of the people white people who are murdered and killed are killed by white people. And in the black community, most of the people who do who attack black people are black people. That is to say, people attack people in their own neighborhoods, and
right,
since we have segregation in America, most of the people who are going to be preying on black people are black people themselves.
Uh-huh.
Right, and so the question is, how do you transform black neighborhoods, and how do you transform people who are oppressed, who have limited opportunities and so forth? These are the people who are preying on black people. Most of them have had no education. Most of them have no high school diplomas. They are people who have no jobs. And so what they become is people who prey on other people to survive.
Now, I offered that tidbit there, just toss it out there, because to solicit from you and others as I do is to say that that is one of the ways they're taking the wind out of our sails on these issues about violence against black people, police officers killing and shooting people unjustly. Because if we allow them to talk about black-on-black crime, and you hear the many pundits or talking heads, you know that they talk about that, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so I don't hear many African-American leaders standing up and saying, well, yeah, we can talk about the two of them, but let's talk about it. It's as if something we should be ashamed of, and we should be, but what are we going to do to address it?
You see, the problem is here. I'll tell you, I mean, I can speak about New York particularly, is that for 20 years, they have been arresting black people, brutalizing black people. They have the stop and frisk program in which most young black men are stopped who are completely innocent and searched. They go in their pockets and so forth. They use every excuse they can to arrest them.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on for 20 years in New York. And when you ask the mayors like Bloomberg and so on, Giuliani, who started these policies. They say, why are you raising questions about this, you know, about the police? The reason why we do these things is because of all the crime in the black community. You have so much crime, that's why we put the police there, and that's why we have to have this stop and frisk program. It just so happens, though, that when they do that, 90% of the people that they stop, of the black men that they stop, are completely innocent. I've seen it with my own eyes. A person, black people, walking out of their house, and as soon as they get on the sidewalk, they pounce on them and start going through their pockets.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen black men, they were pounced on them when they're in their own garage, on their own property,
mm-hmm.
they run out of the cars, and they grab them.
Right.
This is what's going on. Of course black people have to stop this.
Right.
They can't allow, if you live there, and you have a child, you know, Obama said it himself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If he had a son, he would be Trayvon Martin. That's mm-hmm. what he said.
Well,
I stand with him. He's absolutely right. So you know, this is immediate. Thank goodness my son isn't 15 to 25 years old.
Well, being an African,
I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, being an African American myself, born in Mississippi. When you say 20 years ago they stop and frisk it, that policy started.
Yes.
Well, when
it started in a big way, yes.
So,
there's always been the case, but they increased it. And so within 1 year, they stopped like 600,000 black men in one year.
I understand. And I've been pulled over and asked, where are you going? Show me some ID.
Absolutely.
Going as a young man. I've been stopped and told, well, but we stop you because you look like someone that robbed a bank in Chicago and we
right.
have this picture.
Right.
I've been stopped and saying, what are you doing in this neighborhood? So it's nothing new. But I believe that in New York and all the other states, the behavior is that it's white supremacy. And unless it changes at that level, the police chief, Bloomberg, and all of them. I mean, look at the types that they hire to lead these roles and positions that they hire for in New York and the major cities. It's as if they got a containment issue, a concern, and this guy's going to teach them how to do it.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, they want to put fear in the hearts of black people and black men. That's what they want to do. So that you won't even think of doing something wrong. That's what they think. In order to do that, they have to brutalize most black people.
Right.
That's what they do.
And other examples for myself, you could go in the house and your dog is sitting outside and out rings a gunshot in the midnight and it just shoot your dog. Or you could be sitting there as you do in the summertime and they'll drive by and shoot the dog. To instill fear
right.
in you, but again,
right.
again, the real issues are: do we continue to respond to each individual killing, and then watch the courts? I mean, that's where we're losing it. The court seems to be rigged. We talk about the rogue cop, but the court seems to be as rigged or as kangarooish as if anything I've ever seen in most of these instances. Do you agree?
Well, that's true. That's true. I do agree with that. In general, that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that you can make some progress in the courts, and we're seeing that's going on now. We are making progress in the courts in New York City. It's just that the courts are slow. And it took about 15 years bringing lawsuits against the police department and the city for this stop and frisk. Ultimately, they won. They won last year in federal court, which said that stop and frisk is illegal, that it has to stop. And the federal court appointed a monitor to investigate the police and to have some control over the police. And a lot of other things that have been suggested by the federal court, such as the policemen carrying cameras. So they have to photograph what is going on when they stop people, that sort of thing. So that has just started. That's just started to go into effect now. And stop and frisk has gone down from over 600,000 last year to 50,000.
Right.
So it can be done, but obviously it's still going on. Eric Gardner was as we saw, everyone saw around the world, he was choked to death right in front of, with cameras on. Okay, so it's still going on, and that's why we have a movement going on. The movement, the civil rights movement, in my opinion, of our time, is this movement to stop police brutality. And we have, as you know, demonstrations going on all over the United States. A big one is going on tomorrow in New York City during the Martin Luther King celebration, but they're also going to be protesting against police brutality.
Well, digressing a little bit, at one point I wanted to stress and share with you my concerns is that in the, quote, black communities that I know of, and especially in Los Angeles at one time, the term, the acronym TNA was frequently used by law enforcement. And that brings me back to the main point about the black-on-black crime, because the policeman would get the call and not respond, and they would use they would respond very slow and sluggish-like, and they would come over the radio and say, TNA. You know what that stands for? Typical nigger action. So there is an entire community held at bay and frightened and sleeping in their bathtubs and won't sleep in their beds while we are addressing these issues, because we are really not focusing on the black-on-black crime way we should be. So we hold people in captivity, and they're frightened, and they can, and the police not going to respond. So that is why I say it's hand-in-hand. Both need to be addressed.
You see, I mean, I think, you know, we're talking also here about Martin Luther King. And in my opinion, if Martin Luther King was around today, what would he be doing? Would he be dealing with black-on-black crime? Or would he be dealing with those people who are ostensibly supposed to protect us, as you say, are not protecting us? And in fact, they're brutalizing us.
Right.
I think that Martin Luther King, if he was alive today, he would be in the streets. He would be in the die-in. He would be closing down the streets. He would try to close down a city. That's where he would be, because that's where it is right now. See, the black-on-black crime that you talk about is a complicated issue, and it's an issue of white racism produces black-on-black crime. Every oppressed group has a higher incidence of crime. Everywhere in the world, you'll find that is the case, because oppression produces people turning against each other. They have no future. There's only thing they can do is they take out their frustrations and anger. We do it against each other. That's what we do. So we have to end racism in American society if we're going to do something about black-on-black crime. That's the only way it's going to happen. You know, black people have horrible schools, second-class schools. They have the highest unemployment. There's no jobs and so forth, and there's no future. So black men are alienated. They don't see any road to progress. We, you know, we say, well, they shouldn't feel this way. It's easy to say that. You see? But we haven't transformed the schools. You know, we're not providing a first class education for our children, you know?
So by protesting and having die-ins and what have you, that's going to change the way things are done in the African-American communities or other communities of color or financially strict communities?
I believe so. Yes, I believe so. Uh-huh. And there's nothing like, you know, when we have these frustrations, when we face all this oppression, there's nothing that will do your soul more good than to be out there lying in the street, you know.
So how long of a fight?
That's where it's at. It transforms you and gives you a sense of community with other people, and that you have the feeling that you are not just passive, but you have the possibility of empowering yourself and empowering your community.
Well, I mean, I use the term black on black crime when in fact crime occurs in all of the communities, whether in the Vietnamese communities they prey on one another in instances, and in Korean communities there is a thugs and what have you. But again, this process sit ends and sleep ends and death ends and what have you. How long will that process take, and will we see changes? Will it have an impact on the communities?
Well,
or are you seeing any changes? Are people gravitating to the nonviolence activities within the communities?
We have never seen a movement that's going on now we have never seen before. There are new tactics that are being used that have never been used before here, say, going on around the United States. And we see this in New York, with actually closing down, sitting in, and major streets, and stopping the traffic and so forth that's going on. And it's being led by young people who are sick and tired of what's going on, and sick and tired of being preyed on and so forth. That's number one. Number two, I have never seen such an integrated protest that are going on. Even in the civil rights movement, whites were involved, but not to the level that they're involved in this. It is it's not only a black movement, but it's a black and white movement that's going on now, you know, in New York. You can never predict exactly what's going to happen.
Right.
You see? I mean, you know, that I wish we could. It would be much easier if we could say, we do this, then we're going to succeed. We don't know any more than Martin Luther King knew that whether or not he was going to succeed.
What are some of the solutions that you suggest to address the violence or the unjust killings or harassment, stop and frisk and all?
It's protest. It's protest and more protest. You know, because black people are not going to achieve anything unless they get out in and protest against what's being done against them. You know, just as it was in the civil rights movement. You know, this country is not going to give black people anything. You'll get what you fight for. That's what we will get. And here we are with a black man in the White House, and black people are still not free. Their condition is just as bad as it was. We're segregated. We are given the third-rate schools. We're not given the best jobs and so on. It's only a minority who are succeeding in this society among black people.
Mm-hmm.
White people have 20 times the wealth as the average black person. 20 times the wealth. That's right.
So when
double the income.
When we have the protests, then is there a movement to speak to the police agencies, to the governors of states, to start recruiting and having representation of African Americans in law enforcement? Is there anything that's working as parallel to this, or is it just relying strictly? Is there any discussion or dialogue between those agencies or governors to say? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that having officers on the force that are African American and higher ranking officials that are African American may not have an influence. What do you think?
No, I think it would have an influence, and I think more has to be done in that direction, as you suggest.
Uh-huh.
It definitely should be done. I think one of the problems is that these police forces are often overwhelmingly white. And that's been true in New York City until recently, and just starting to bring in more people of color into the police department. But unfortunately, even in New York City, most of those minorities are Hispanic in New York City, and there's still a real shortage of African Americans on the police force. Well, one thing, it is not as a lot of black men look at it as not a desirable job for black people, because they're expected to act like white police and to brutalize white people, black people, the way the white cops do as well. Unfortunately, if you're a black cop, they tell you, and I went to the trial when they had the stop and frisk trial in New York, and you get a black policeman on the stand, and he's told to go out and stop, you know, a certain percentage of black men. That's what you have to do, and they go out and have to do it too.
So then this is a systemic problem in that agencies are, who are they serving? Who is giving the ultimate order? Is it the governor, or is it legislators who want to contain African Americans, people of color in certain communities?
For sure, for sure.
How so? Is there any record, any history, anybody come out with that?
Is there any record that
has anyone?
Absolutely. The fight that's going on in New York now is between the police department and the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor won on an anti-stop and frisk, stop brutalizing black people program, and he was elected on that. And so now the police have turned against him. They say that he's partly responsible. Blood is on his hands in the chokehold killing, you know, not the chokehold killing, in the killing of the two police officers that were murdered. And they said he's responsible for that. And so they're trying to bring down the mayor. So this conflict is going on. We're seeing it played out right now, you know, against a racist police department. This is a major fight that's going on. The question is, will we win that fight? That's the question.
Oh, you will win it. It's changeable and doable. But I think we have to incorporate every aspect of it and not be shy. And again, I lived in Gary, Indiana, there at 14th and Adams for a while, right?
Yeah.
As if there's any place called hell on earth, that would be it. Would have been it.
Mm-hmm, right.
You follow, and you go to Gary, Indiana now, and you see how ripped and shredded it is,
right,
structurally, socially, and what have you.
Right.
What happened? Yeah, what happened? I mean, the guys that are dealing the drugs get picked off around the perimeters, but internally, they're just inflicting great injury on the community.
Well, I mean, I don't know, you know, I've never lived in Gary, Indiana, but I understand it's become predominantly a black city. And like a lot of places around the country, like Detroit and so forth, you say Newark, New Jersey, you know, around near New York City,
right,
where I live, is what happened. White people, they decided they're getting out of here because the jobs moved, you know, there was a lack of jobs and so forth, and white people moved out where the jobs were. They moved out to the suburbs. That's where they went,
mm-hmm,
you know, and they went there. And why didn't the blacks move out to the suburbs? Because blacks couldn't move out to the suburbs because they couldn't live out there. They couldn't find housing out there. And the whole housing program was discriminatory against, mm-hmm, blacks. They couldn't get mortgages and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So who was left in the cities? Black folks,
mm-hmm,
with no jobs and so forth, and the cities deteriorated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a racial thing and a racist issue.
So that's what
happened.
The stop and frisk issue is it still being taken on in court, or that was resolved completely?
It was resolved. Yes, it was resolved by the federal courts that the people who are fighting against it won. They won decisively.
Uh-huh.
They won decisively, and so the police department is really up against it because they're losing.
So
they're losing.
Would be
happening politically. They're losing in the courts, and they're losing politically because the black and Hispanic people in New York City elected a mayor. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. Most white people did not vote for him. Bill de Blasio, who happens to have a black wife and two black children, you see, and, you know, who are subject to the same oppression, there is his black family, as all black people, he's mm-hmm. different. Mm-hmm. And he's determined he was going to do something about it. Now, we will see what happens. But I can tell you, if we win in New York, we'll win all over this country because New York is that important.
Who is actually, who led that fight on the actual legal, was it ACLU or what agency or organization?
ACLU was involved, and there's another organization called Constitutional Organization that was also involved. So it was a combination of organizations that started this many, many years ago.
You know, the mindset of most police agencies and the ones that I've, even federal agencies that I've worked for, many of the officers and agents and supervisors believe that African Americans would make pretty good guys on the cover guys because you see they're predisposed. They've already been out there dealing drugs and selling drugs and pimping and doing all. Really, I mean, and so. You know, give a brother a gun and get him a diamond ring in the ear, a stud in the ear, and put him on the cover. But put him in a community working, you understand, because we supposed to, by natural instinct, be able to be good covert operative because we know the dirty tricks, right? And which is far from the truth. It's an age-old mentality, a mindset within agencies that contribute to the violence against African Americans, and also the desire of the mayor and others with money to keep certain communities, gated communities, patrolled and clean. You go through Beverly Hills and you pluck off the streets quickly, right? There'll be an army of cars, but go over to Inglewood and see what you get.
Mm-hmm.
You representation. Most of the energy is focused in the gated communities, and if any are dare seen driving in that area, that's where what stimulates.
But all white communities are in a sense gated communities, right? And patrol any black person walking in a white neighborhood, they spend special attention mm-hmm. is given to them. Essentially, you know, we watch them. What are they doing here? Because there's this stereotype that black men are criminals.
Mm-hmm.
That all black men are criminals. And that you have to watch them and keep them under control. You see, the police department, you know, you say black on black crime. The police department is there to protect white people, not to protect black people.
Well,
It's not for black people.
I understand that, and that's why I say that. You know, we must. I'll try and pull every coattail that I can, and say we must start to address this because while we're struggling to fight and change the bigger picture, there are entire communities that are struggling and suffering, and 5-year-olds being shot and 3-year-olds being shot on the grandparents' lap. You know, these kinds of things. Can we wait that long until this thing plays out and then we get the benefits? Should we not be capable of speaking to both issues simultaneously?
Well, yes, we can do both issues. I mean, you brought up the issue of more black policemen. Mm-hmm. I think more black policemen would make a great deal of progress. I think it would help a great deal. But in order to do that, you often have to control the police departments themselves
mm-hmm.
to bring that out and have a new type of policing. That's what we want to try to do.
And
you know?
The picking of attorney generals, the appointing of attorney generals, the appointing of U.S. attorneys and prosecutors will also has a great influence in the play in this and dictate how the officer will treat African Americans, anyone out on the street.
I think that's true.
And so the thrust should be, in my opinion, focusing too on those systems because they don't hire many African Americans, as we know, but when they do hire them, you want to understand something that's really frustrating. you know, they say you have to work double as hard to because you're African American.
Right.
To prove, no, you entered the agency and immediately they want to know if they can trust you, first of all. You understand? Then they want to know, can they let you in on the little secrets? Because, you know, you're still African American and you might sue us if we tell an ugly joke around you. Or you might squeal on us if you see we violate someone's rights. So it's a hell of a road and to hoe in the police agencies and the enforcement agencies. And when you see the attorney general with the this matter with what's the young man that was killed? What's Michael Brown?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, in Ferguson.
What do you think about the fact? The way it was handled, as we see now with the attorney general and the grand jury in that process.
Well, of course, that was an outrage. Yeah. It was an outrage. You
well,
know,
some of the
I mean, yeah, not to indict that officer. It was an outrage, but the same thing happened in New York. They didn't indict the we watched the man being choked to death. He had his arm around a man's neck, and he wasn't indicted either.
Right.
So that's what happens. That goes on all over. I mean, when they murder somebody, when a white cop murders a black person, nothing happens to them.
That's it.
So there's no accountability. And how can that happen in a society? What does that tell you about a society? That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they representing? Why are they doing that to a people? They don't do that to white people. Why are they doing it to black people?
Well,
what is the function of that? You know, if the function of that is to keep black people in a depressed condition in American society. We're a lower caste people in American society, and it doesn't happen by itself. If they didn't get up off our necks, we wouldn't be where we are. We would be on the same level as white people or even higher if they would get up off of us, just as they stopped getting on the case of Asian people, and they rised up and they're doing better than white people.
The
and that's what we would be too.
But then that becomes an imbalance. We don't want to accomplish that, do we? Where we find ourselves doing better than whites?
We want to rise to the level we can rise to.
Okay.
That's what we want to do, the way other people are able to do. But we're not able to do that. White people can do that to a greater extent than we can.
Mm-hmm. So this is you'll be here for how long?
I will be here for about a week.
Okay.
My brother's funeral is on this coming Friday. People are welcome to come to the funeral. I hope they will. It's at 2:30 on Friday, January 23rd, at St. Andrew's Episcopal Cathedral.
Now, Bill was... can you... Marsha, are you there?
Yes.
Can you tell us some of the things that Bill's quite active in the NAACP and civil rights movements here in Hawaii for some while, an extended period of time?
Bill was, like most of us, was really instrumental in securing the holiday, as were hundreds of people. But Bill quietly never made a fuss about anything, but he was always there, and he was the kind that got things done. You know, the type of people that cross the T's, dot the I's, where the rest of us kind of float around, whatnot. Bill was solid, 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 always on the line. You know, he took a position and made sure it happened. And when we got the holiday in 1988, and at that time, there was a whole lot of money. The state had money. And they had a Martin Luther King Commission. And then when the state ran out of money, we had to go and become a nonprofit. So Bill quietly was part of that nonprofit, and that's what we've been ever since. We've had to raise our own money to do our own thing.
The MLK...
Martin Luther King Coalition, yeah.
Coalition, okay, when you say organization.
Not the NAACP. That's
okay,
That's totally different. And
but he was involved within the NAACP, if I'm not mistaken, was he not?
I don't know. I can't answer that.
Oh, okay.
My relationship with him was not through the NAACP. I mean, we, like, you know, we go to their events and whatnot, but I don't know if he was ever active. He may have been. Now, don't get me wrong. It's just that I don't know that. But I do know that he was always there for Martin Luther King. He was the backbone of the parade in terms of organizing and making sure that everything happened, that everything went on schedule. And I don't care if you were there or not, the parade started right on the button at 9 o'clock. And Bill said, it starts now, 9 o'clock. You all can be just organized if you want, but you're going.
You're fading out there, Marcia.
Am I there?
Yeah. I probably drop you completely here. Marcia, I can barely hear you. Call back and we'll try to pick you up again. Are you there, Billy? Larry?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Yeah. So your brother, 230 St. Andrew's Episcopal, there at Baratania and Alakia, something in that area?
I can't tell you the streets, not being that familiar with Honolulu, but it's in downtown Honolulu. They have a website. You could go to a website if you're not sure where it's located.
Yeah, Marcia, what is the actual address of that?
Of what building?
The church.
Oh, the church is on Baratania Street at Queen Emma Street, right across from the Capitol, next to the Washington Place.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you going to go ahead with the trash? You mentioned there possibly a trash ride. Is that going to play out?
The corp council called hysterical that if we had somebody to ride with the garbage workers, the liability, you know, as only attorneys can get hoo-hooed. The rubbish department was okay with it, but the corp council just went crazy, went ballistic.
You would, tell the listeners what it was about. I mean,
okay.
We only spoke in fragments, if real quick.
Okay.
And we don't have a lot of time, so.
All right. Quick. We have every year we have the big yellow garbage truck in the parade, and with a banner that says Memphis We Remember. And it was because Martin Luther King was in Memphis for the garbage strike when he was killed. So every year we have the big yellow truck, and we honor the rubbish workers. So Reverend Brownridge, Father Brownridge, who is the dean of the cathedral, wanted to ride with the rubbish workers as they went to work. And at first they said it was okay, and then they, like I said,
the city said it was okay.
The rubbish department said it was okay.
Okay, the city, okay.
And then the corp council went crazy, as only attorneys can do, you know.
But going crazy is, did they deny it?
Yes.
Okay, they did not allow it.
Yes.
Okay.
So, but, now, he can ride on the truck in the parade, just not as they work.
I see.
And we will also have a city bus in the parade, that because this is the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott. So the city has provided us with a bus and an African-American driver so that we acknowledge the 60th anniversary of the bus boycott. All of those things, all of those pieces are a part of this holiday, because Martin Luther King is a symbol of all of the people for hundreds of years that have sacrificed and toiled for this day.
Okay. Mr. Rushing, you have anything in closing? We got 1 minute, if you could.
No, it's just I'd like just to reiterate the importance of this event. You have a magnificent parade here in Hawaii, and I'm glad to be able to participate in it and, in a sense, honor the memory of William Bill Rushing, who had so much to do with it. I really envy you here in Honolulu to have such a great parade. I wish we had one in Brooklyn where I live. Maybe someday we'll have something like you're having.
Okay. Hey, well, thank you guys. And
can I add one thing?
Just one thing.
Quick. Yes. Bill's internment will be at Punch Bowl at 1 o'clock on Friday.
Okay.
So anybody that wants to come for the internment, it's at Punch Bowl at 1 o'clock on
Okay.
Friday.
Well, thank you guys for joining.
Thank you very much.
Aloha.
And we'll see you there at the parade.
Okay.
All
right. Aloha.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI.